4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great Acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, a program where we ask the question, what does it mean to be living in the new geologic age? I'm your host, Mike Osborne, and today's interview is with geoengineering expert Granger Morgan. Stay tuned.
Hi, my name is Daniel Tachik, and I'm joined here by my co-host, Ellis Robinson.
That's me.
And we're both PhD engineering students at Carnegie Mellon University. And today we're joined by Professor Granger Morgan, who heads the Department of Engineering and Public Policy here.
He's also the director of the Climate Decision-Making Center here at CMU. And today we're going to be talking to him mostly about his work with geoengineering. And so with that, Granger Morgan, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
So to start off conceptually, what is geoengineering?
Well, actually, geoengineering is a word that's too broad to be terribly useful. The Royal Society ran a study a few years ago that actually helped a great deal in differentiating between two kinds of activities, something they called CDR, carbon dioxide removal, a variety of activities to actually remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and SRM, solar radiation management, a variety of strategies essentially to increase the amount of sunlight that's reflected back into space, something called the albedo. It's a very slow process, any way you slice it, to take CO2 out of the atmosphere. On the other hand, it's a pretty fast process to cool the Earth by putting very fine reflective particles into the stratosphere.
For people that might not understand what aerosols do up in the stratosphere, in the simplest way, like how is that going to cool our climate?
Okay, well, so sunlight comes in and hits the Earth. About 70% of it is immediately reflected back out into space from the ground, from clouds, from snow and other things. And 30% of it gets absorbed. And when it gets absorbed, it then can't get back out into space easily because while the atmosphere is transparent in the visible wavelengths, it's opaque in the infrared, that is, in heat. And, you know, if you warm up the surface of the planet and it tries to radiate energy back into space, it's like a radiator. It's going to radiate in the infrared, and that energy gets trapped until the equilibrium temperature of the Earth rises enough so that the same amount, I mean, we've got to get that the same amount of energy back into space as is absorbed, because otherwise we'd heat up very quickly and all fry. And so what happens is that the operating temperature of the entire planet rises a little bit, and that's the so-called greenhouse effect, which is actually a very good thing because natural greenhouse warming, mainly from water vapor, but also from small amounts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, is what makes this planet a pleasant and livable space. So I talked about 30% getting reflected back out into space. And if I can jack that fraction by just a couple of percent, then I lower the fraction that gets absorbed. And so other strategies that people have talked about are things like putting mirrors in stable orbital locations between us and the sun. This is obviously very much in the almost Buck Rogers kind of realm, but there are people, you know, who work on this. The reason I have focused principally on fine particles in the stratosphere is that that's almost certainly something that is feasible, that one could do. And what you're basically doing is adding a little bit of a mirror, a little bit more reflectivity to make sure that the light energy doesn't all get down and get absorbed in the surface, to cut back on the amount of absorbed energy.
So to me, when I first heard about this idea of injecting particles into the stratosphere and just having it spread over the entire globe, honestly, it just sounded kind of insane. With that being said, where did this idea even come from? What's the story on how this came to be?
Well, first of all, your reaction that this is sort of nuts is a very healthy reaction. It's the reaction that anybody with their head screwed on straight has almost immediately. Though people have begun to try to study and understand direct and indirect effects that solar radiation management might have, I don't think we can be, certainly at this stage, we can't be at all confident that if we were to do this in terms of how things would play out. Now, the idea is, as I said, not at all new, and that's because anybody who's worked in climate science knows that aerosols in the atmosphere play an important role in the radiative balance of the planet. And as a matter of fact, back when the first discussions at the presidential level in this country occurred on climate change many administrations back, the only strategy that got advanced was a strategy of geoengineering for dealing with climate change.
So have we witnessed this effect when volcanoes erupt?
Yeah. Yeah, the last big explosion resulted in about a half a degree reduction in average global temperature for over a year.
Wow.
So, there's nothing hypothetical about this. We know it works. Now, we also know, as I said, that it's imperfect, and of course, you need to keep putting more fine particles into the stratosphere because they'll gradually decay away. The other issue is that at some level, it's sort of a Faustian bargain. So I start doing this, and then I go a few decades, and CO2 concentrations continue to rise, but I'm putting in just enough to offset it. And then if for some geopolitical or other reason suddenly things stop, the stuff's all going to decay out quite quickly. And so rather than this very gradual increase in temperature, you're suddenly going to see a whopping big spike in the increased temperature. And while ecosystems are going to have enough problem dealing with the gradual growing temperatures, if you subject them to a whopping big increase, then, of course, it could be ecologically disastrous. The other thing is, as I said, you don't do anything to offset the continual rise of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, rising CO2. A substantial fraction of the order of half of the CO2 that goes into the atmosphere ends up ultimately being absorbed in the oceans. And so the oceans today are about 30% more acidic than they were in pre-industrial times. And if we keep going as we are at the moment, most of the coral experts that I talk with tell me that probably all coral reefs will be gone by the end of the century, simply because the polyps can no longer lay down the calcium carbonate structure.
Yeah, so just to be clear, I mean, those effects of climate change, they sound disastrous. And geoengineering has the potential to fix our temperature at some level below some certain tipping point.
But the example I was just giving you of acidification is, that would continue. Because you see, geoengineering does nothing to offset the rise of CO2.
And so that's a point that I guess you try to make clear. And so this does some things, but it's not a perfect fix.
That's right. I mean, if we got into a real jam, if it turns out there's a climate cliff out there and we seem to be falling off it, this might be a way to buy a bit of time. But I also think that, well, to be perfectly frank, in this country, the United States, I think there are a number of folks who are currently in the climate denial mode who philosophically are of a persuasion that the planet is for humankind to, manage and dominate. And so if and when it finally gets, well, it will get to the point that these folks can no longer argue that there isn't climate change, at which point the response might be, fine, well, let's just go fix it. By which I mean, let's go engineer the planet. And at the very least, I would like to see us at a point where we understand these issues much better before, either Americans or others around the world start making those kinds of arguments. At the moment, the amount of research going on is very modest, and so a number of us have argued for quite a while that we really need an expanded program of research, both because there is the odds, there's growing odds that somebody somewhere might propose to do this, and we need to be informed to have an international discourse, but also because, you know, we ourselves might at some stage be forced to do a bit of it.
Well, and this is something that you've written kind of extensively about in places like Nature and Foreign Policy, advocating that we need more research so that we can understand the assured side effects that something like this would bring. And so I guess, can you talk to us about what are some of the things that we know that we don't know and some of the consequences we could expect from doing something like this?
Well, what we know we don't know is unclear. So, for example, if I put fine particles in the stratosphere, depending upon the nature of the particles, their surfaces might become catalytic sites for ozone destruction. We don't really know a lot about those processes. We don't know whether and how one can disperse the right-sized particles. There's just a whole lot of things we still don't know. It certainly looks that you could do this quite inexpensively. It's also quite unclear how the distributional effects will work. I mentioned Kate Rickey doing a PhD with me. The bottom line on Kate's work is that if you set out at some stage to do solar radiation management, what would be optimal for, say, China will not be the same thing as what's optimal for India, and that over time the two will move away from each other. Now, they're both going to be climates that are much closer to today's climate than a climate 50 or 100 years from now, but still it sounds like there's the basis for some interesting international disagreements there. The other thing that David Keith keeps reminding me of is that, not everybody in the world is going to find all aspects of climate change undesirable. And so one could imagine some amazing arguments about don't put the climate back to the way it was. I mean, I rather like the fact that my, really icy cold winters have gotten significantly less severe.
Okay, so I guess, are we as a society ever going to be comfortable enough that we could really think of doing this?
I think it would take a real climate emergency. There are folks who are arguing that, you ought to treat geoengineering just like any other climate abatement strategy and put it in a mix and do, optimal calculations to figure out what's the most cost-effective strategy. Problem, of course, is that these sort of benefit-cost methods only make sense when you got a uniform set of values. And so what my values are and what the values of a Quechua traditional Indian in the altiplanos of Ecuador and Peru may think is optimal, or what Inuit in and other First Nation people in northern Canada think is optimal, almost certainly is very different. So this notion that one can, do a model to estimate the optimal climate policy, I think is just sort of nuts.
Well, and yet, given all these things we don't know and all these different values of various players that could make some decision, it sounds like what you're saying is that if someone had $8 or $10 billion,
yeah,
and they wanted to do this right now, they could. Am I understanding
right.
that right?
There are individuals around the world with enough resources to unilaterally go do this. I don't think that's a serious issue, but it gives you a sense of scale. But there are also major states which could be that could do this unilaterally. It's not immediately clear how you could tell them, cut it out, which is another reason, though, why I think it's so important that you understand what can and can't be done and what the downsides might be, so that if and when we ever do get to the point of somebody unilaterally taking action because, for example, precipitation patterns have shifted and they can't feed their populace, that at least we have the basis for an informed international discourse. I'm not worried about, small island states, for example, are obviously at enormous risk from climate change. They're likely going to go underwater. But to be a little crude about it, the U.S. Navy can stop them from engaging in geoengineering. It's not clear the U.S. Navy can stop you know, Russia or China or India or Brazil from doing this should they choose to.
So if you, Granger Morgan, were the one calling the shots, what would the situation with climate have to be before you would say, let's do this?
Well, the question is, how many shots do I get to call? Do I get to call shots right now on implementing a serious abatement of CO2? Because if the answer is yes, that's on the table, then I would start out with major federal investments to get us over the hump and start down the learning curve on things like carbon capture and deep geologic sequestration, which we're going to need not just on coal plants, but also on gas plants. I would put enormously larger efforts into using the energy we've got much more efficiently. And so if you allow me to call those shots as well, and we go a few decades and we've still got a problem, and, you know, there are millions of people whose livelihood or even whose existence is at risk around the planet, then I could imagine a scenario under which collectively as a planet we might decide to do something. But I'm sure not at the point of arguing that we ought to be contemplating doing this today. One of the things that I don't think, though, that many people on Capitol Hill and in the general public understand is how different the climate problem is from the problem of local and regional air pollution. I mean, the residence time in the atmosphere of sulfate aerosols or other conventional air pollutants is hours to days. And that's not true of greenhouse gases. I mean, if I put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, the residence time is decades to centuries. So to stabilize concentrations, I have to dramatically reduce emissions by an order of magnitude. And I don't think most Americans have yet got that fact figured out, and the system has enormous inertia. So we're building in, I mean, even if we could somehow stop all emissions today, we would already be committed to a significant amount of climate change, and we don't fully understand the climate system, and so hopefully we're nowhere near, you know, a sudden switch to a totally different climate state, but we can't be absolutely confident of that, and so that's the other reason why I think this is something that needs to be studied.
So it sounds to me like even thinking about doing geoengineering, correct me if I'm wrong, in your opinion, is kind of a last resort emergency type of action.
Well, I certainly continue to think of it that way, but there are growing numbers of people in the world who have moved past that and are beginning to think of it as just one of several things that you do as a portfolio of strategies to deal with the climate problem.
Daniel and I were talking about this beforehand. I guess one of the things that I've always grappled with when thinking about geoengineering is, regardless of whether we know everything about intended consequences or not, it's always going to be kind of a small subset of people making this one decision. And so just the idea that someone could wield that kind of power, I guess, over the environment, I don't know how to make sense of that. I don't know.
It's,
what do you think about it?
It's a scary thought, isn't it? And actually, we ran a workshop in Washington as part of our climate center just this spring on the management of knowledge about geoengineering. For a while, for example, was contemplating possibilities like not allowing private intellectual property for technologies to do this. I think I have been dissuaded from making that argument. But there have been a few folks who have patented ideas in the past. I frankly don't think that if, for example, a major aircraft company owned a patent on a dispersal or a strategy that there's much risk of their becoming a key player in the political process to urge adoption of this. On the other hand, you know, agriculturists across the Midwestern United States or in other vulnerable regions might well be. And so how these things would play out in the politics, especially of representative democracies, is a messy issue. But when I was talking about, I mean, I guess the two extremes are that, you know, a country, perhaps not a particularly democratic country, decides unilaterally, okay, we're just going to do this because things have gotten so terrible. The other extreme, of course, is a UN or international-based negotiation where one says, oh, gee, sea level rise is inundating through storm surge people all over the world, and there are millions of people who can't feed themselves because climate change has gotten so severe and so on. And so one could imagine some sort of a collective decision through international organizations to engage in this. I think we're a long way from it being even too useful to think about that. It is useful to think right now, though, about the governance and oversight of research. And my own view, one that I have expressed to the House Science Committee and in other places as well, is that all research in this area ought to be open. The world ought to be able to know what's going on, that it would be absolutely inappropriate for research to be going on as black programs in the national security or intelligence communities, and that we need to begin to develop mechanisms to make sure the world does know who's doing what and what's coming out of this work. And as a matter of fact, this workshop I mentioned that we ran in Washington was exploring those issues, and several of us are now writing a paper to try to articulate some of those arguments.
Hmm. Well, Granger, this has been really, really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. We're so happy to have you on the show, and thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank co-producers Tom Hayden and Miles Traer for all their behind-the-scenes work, as well as Leslie Chang, Maxine Luckett, and Sam Larson. Special thanks to Pam Madsen, Dean of Stanford School of Earth Sciences. A very special thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song, Monoliths. Thanks also to KZSU Stanford 90.1, where all of our interviews were recorded. You can find past episodes of Generation Anthropocene at anthropocene.stanford.edu. Follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?